Well, thank you very much, Alan, and good afternoon, everybody. As always, it's a great pleasure to be here in Perth. My talk today is about recent economic developments, because, as you know, after having held interest rates steady in Australia here for 5 months, earlier this month the Reserve Bank raised interest rates again a little, and since then we've put out the minutes of that board meeting and the statement on monetary policy, which gives some background on all these on these decisions. So I thought I'd spend the time today sort of going through some of that material. As always, the global economy is very important in shaping developments here in Australia. So I'll start by talking about what's happening around the globe. The world economy at the moment is actually quite divided. The United States and Europe and Japan are struggling to recover from the global financial crisis, while the emerging Asian economies and to a lesser extent Latin America are actually growing very strongly. The United States economy clearly lost momentum around the middle of this year. It had been recovering, but it lost momentum there for in the June and September quarters. And GDP growth slowed to about 2% through those quarters. And this is clearly below their potential growth rate. Our reading of the US data since then is that they're a little bit stronger again, which is a good sign. But nonetheless, consumer confidence in America remains very low. The housing and the labour markets are very weak. And the repair of household balance sheets has still got a long way to run. So basically, the US household sector is in very poor shape. One of the features of the US economy that's changed over the past 50 years or so is that households are now bearing much more of the brunt of recessions than used to be the case, and businesses are bearing less. So after each downturn, it has taken progressively longer for employment to regain its previous peak. Even after the 2001 downturn, which was a pretty mild downturn in America in terms of GDP, it took almost four years, for employment in America to recover its peak. The current downturn has been much more severe, with employment falling by 6% from peak to trough, and the recovery in employment so far being quite tepid. So it's therefore going to take quite some time yet before employment regains its pre-crisis levels. Weak labour markets, of course, mean that household income growth is very weak, and the combination of job losses and low income growth has led to a big rise in mortgage foreclosures. Almost 1 in 20 houses that are mortgaged in America are currently in foreclosure, and this is obviously a very high figure. Household wealth in America has fallen sharply. If you measure it relative to household income, it's back to the level of the late 1980s. So clearly a lot of wealth has been wiped out. At the same time, household gearing has increased sharply, with housing debt now equal to about 55% of the value of the US housing stock. Again, a very high figure. So understandably, the reaction of households to all this has been to stop borrowing, cut back on spending, increase savings. And all of that means that US households are not going to be the driving force of the global economy that they were in the period since, say, the mid-1990s. The US corporate sector, on the other hand, is in pretty good shape. Profits have recovered strongly, and the arrears rates on loans by US corporates has peaked at what is quite a relatively mild level compared with the past. It's no higher than it was in the 2001 recession, which, as I said, was quite a mild recession. And also, holdings of cash by US corporations are at very high levels. They're currently holding about $1.5 trillion US dollars of cash, which is about equal to about 20% of all the debt they've issued. So this means that US corporations are in a very strong position to increase their investment once confidence returns. The US Federal Reserve has been maintaining official interest rates at close to zero since late 2008. But despite this, the US economy has remained sluggish. and the Fed's been trying to use other instruments to get the economy going again. These measures generally fall under the heading of quantitative easing, and they involve expanding the Fed's balance sheet through the purchase of securities, with payment for those securities being made by giving banks extra deposits at the Federal Reserve. The Fed has roughly tripled the size of its balance sheet since the crisis began to over $2,000 billion. And earlier this month, it foreshadowed that it would be prepared to buy another $600 billion US Treasuries if circumstances warrant. So clearly, it's bought a lot of securities. The objective of all this has been to put downward pressure on market interest rates so as to encourage households and businesses to borrow, and to provide the banks with extra liquidity to encourage them to lend. But as I said, US households have little appetite for debt at present. US corporations, on the other hand, are flush with cash and don't need to borrow. And the banks are generally happy to just leave the extra liquidity they've got on deposit with the Fed. So US banks at the moment are holding about 8% of their assets on deposit with the Fed, and their loans to businesses and households are falling. These outcomes are pretty typical of what happens in the wake of a financial crisis, because it takes a long time for households, businesses and banks to repair the damage that was done to their balance sheets and start borrowing and lending again. And this unfortunately means a prolonged period of subpar growth. In Europe, growth has been about average over the past year, but there's a very big divergence within Europe. Germany is doing very well. It's benefiting from earlier economic reforms, very disciplined economic policies, and Chinese demand for German capital goods. But at the other extreme, Greece and Ireland are experiencing very deep recessions, as you know. Economic tensions have been building within the euro area because of widening differentials in competitiveness. Unit labour costs in Greece, for example, have risen by about 25% relative to those in Germany since the euro was formed. And this, understandably, is making it very difficult for businesses in Greece. Government debt problems are also probably at their most acute in Europe. Earlier this year, the European government set up a facility to provide funding for the smaller countries. And for a time, that seemed to lessen market concerns about debt. Things calmed down. But as you know, in recent times, the situation has deteriorated again quite a lot, as markets again question the capacity of some countries to sustain their current debt levels. On the other hand, as I mentioned, Asia is a bright spot in the global economy. The region bounced back very strongly from the global financial crisis, and economic activity in all the emerging Asian economies has now surpassed its previous peak. Several central banks in the region have recently been tightening monetary policy, but generally policy settings in Asia remain quite expansionary. Now, some commentators have been concerned that the recent tightening might lead to an excessive slowing in Asia, particularly in China. But this doesn't seem likely, whatever the settings of monetary policy are on the expansionary side. In fact, economic activity in China recently has started to pick up again. So in Asia, inflation is the issue that could become, you know, the core policy challenge if growth remains strong. And there are already signs that inflation in Asia has picked up noticeably, particularly in food prices. And of course, some Asian economies have experienced very sharp rises in house prices, reflecting the very favourable economic and financial conditions. Overall, the outcome for global economic growth over the past year has been quite strong. When the figures for 2010 finally come in, they're likely to show that the world economy grew by about 4.75%, which is noticeably above trend. Now, most forecasters are expecting we're not going to have that repeated over the next couple of years. We're going to have a slower growth rate, but still close to trend. So the overall results for the world economy are pretty good. But there are, of course, risks to these outcomes arising from some of the issues I've mentioned. In the developed economies, the concerns are mainly about risks to the downside. And what's worrying people is that the capacity of the authorities in these countries to deal with any renewed economic slowdown might be limited because policy settings, you know, monetary and fiscal policy, are already at fairly extreme levels. In Asia, on the other hand, it's easier to see risks of overheating. The growth in the world economy that's occurred over the past year has resulted in a significant lift in commodity prices. And the prices of the two commodities of most importance to Australia, which is iron ore and coal, have been especially strong, and they have been rising again in recent weeks. So as a consequence, Australia's terms of trade, which is the ratio of our export prices to import prices, have now surpassed the high level they got to in 2008 and are pretty much at unparalleled levels. This is adding a lot of income to the country. We think something like $25 billion over the past year or so. So the question is, how long will all this last? And at the bank, we've been forecasting for some time that there will be a gradual reduction in the terms of trade as the supply of commodities picks up and as demand slows down in line with the slight slowing in the global economy. And we continue to forecast this, but I have to say recently, the way commodity prices have been moving, we've had to revise up our forecasts. And beyond the next couple of years, it's hard to predict what will happen. But China and India at the moment, they're going through a phase of their development which is very intensive in the use of steel. Most economies go through this. And if you look at the history of other countries that have gone through this, this sort of phase can last for up to 20 years. So it's likely that China, and more particularly India, will have a strong demand for steel for a long time yet. And this, of course, is a very favourable environment for the Australian economy. So let me turn now to the Australian economy. As you know, our economy recovered relatively quickly from what was a fairly shallow downturn following the global financial crisis. And over the past year, it has grown at around its trend rate of about 3.25%. But domestic demand has grown substantially faster than this, about 5.25%, due importantly to public spending, although this is now moderating. Consumer spending has been reasonably soft. It's growing below trend. It seems that even though consumer confidence is very high, consumers are pretty cautious in their spending. The household saving ratio has picked up a lot from the low point it got to earlier this decade. And as we've said before, a period of consolidation by Australian households after what was 10 to 15 years of pretty robust increase in spending and gearing is probably no bad thing. Investment in new dwellings has increased over the past year, though the growth in the number of dwellings for Australia as a whole is still falling short of the growth of the population. And as a result, rental markets are tightening, vacancy rates are falling, and rents are growing at a pretty solid pace. At the same time, however, households appear to be less inclined to increase gearing in order to trade up to better quality housing. Auction clearance rates have fallen back to around long-run average levels, and house prices have been relatively flat across Australia in recent months. This is in keeping with the more financially conservative approach that Australian households have taken recently. These trends are probably most pronounced here in Perth because Perth seems to be going through a period of adjustment after the euphoria of 2006-2007. Business conditions generally are around average levels, although there are very clear differences across sectors of the economy. Business investment is at a high level, particularly in the mining industry. And information published by the Australian Bureau of Statistics, as well as our own liaison with companies, suggests that investment will pick up sharply further over the next couple of years. And in this regard, I want to take a minute just to acknowledge the very important role that our Perth office here, led by Virginia Christie, plays in helping us to understand what's happening, particularly in the mining industry. And I would particularly like to thank the many businesses that regularly take time to talk to Virginia and her team. It's of great importance to the bank, and we really value that, so thank you. One segment of business investment that remains very weak is non-residential building. Following large increases in gearing and commercial property prices in 2006 and 2007, the commercial property market has been deleveraging and prices have fallen. I think the bulk of that adjustment is now probably over, but the availability of finance for commercial property is very tight. Employment across the country has grown strongly over the past year, and the unemployment rate has fallen back into the range of 5 to 5.5%, which historically has indicated a degree of tightness in the labour market. Other indicators of the labour market, however, suggest that it might not be as tight as suggested by the unemployment rate, so we're watching that closely. The financial side of the economy remains subdued. Household credit is growing at a moderate rate, and business credit is very soft. That softness is largely in relation to large businesses. Lending to small businesses, in fact, increased in recent months, and so far this year has increased at an annual rate of about 5%. We spent a fair bit of time at the bank looking at the question of why business credit is so soft. It's pretty clear that banks did tighten their lending standards pretty severely following the onset of the global crisis, and that no doubt contributed to the slowdown in business credit. And this was most acute, as I said, in the commercial property area, where there's been a very sharp cutback in finance, particularly by foreign-owned banks. More recently, there are signs that banks are becoming more willing to lend again, at least in areas other than commercial property. But demand for loans in total is not particularly strong. That's what they're reporting. And it seems that the investment that's taking place in Australia at present and particularly in the case of the mining industry, is largely being financed outside the banking sector, either through retained earnings or direct investment from overseas, or through capital market raisings. The exchange rate has also been having a big impact on business conditions. As you know, it's at a high level. In fact, it's at a post-float high. Although the real effective exchange rate is still lower than the peak it got to in the resources boom of the 1970s. The rise in the exchange rate is a natural consequence of the resource boom, and for the economy as a whole, it's helpful in allowing the economy to adjust. But nonetheless, some sectors of the economy are adversely affected, and a noticeable example at the moment is the tourism industry, where there's been a boom in Australians heading off overseas rather than taking holidays domestically. This is having a very severe effect in traditional holiday destinations in Queensland, which unfortunately are also areas which are suffering from the consequences of overbuilding in the pre-crisis years. So they're suffering a double impact, and it's not surprising that these areas are currently experiencing the highest rates of unemployment in the country. And the Reserve Bank is watching developments in these areas quite closely. So while there are differences between sectors and between regions, the economy overall is doing pretty well. We expect that the economy will continue to grow at a solid pace over the next couple of years, with growth, if anything, picking up to an above-trend rate over towards the end of the forecast period. And this will be accompanied by further increases in jobs and falls in unemployment. But with the economy now having grown more or less without interruption for 20 years, it's understandable that spare capacity is pretty limited. And what that means is that the capacity of the economy to grow much above its potential rate without causing inflation is really not there. So with a large amount of money continuing to flow into the country over the next couple of years because of the resources boom, the challenge is going to be to manage the economy in a way that keeps economic growth on a sustainable path with inflation low. And this is really what the Reserve Bank's trying to do. At present, inflation is broadly in the middle of our target range, but over the medium term, as growth in the economy picks up, pressures on inflation are more likely to be on the upside than the downside. And this is reflected in our forecast, which we published recently, which show that inflation is rising towards the end of our forecast period after being stable, probably likely to be stable for the next year or so. But for this reason, the board of the Reserve Bank decided at its meeting earlier this month that it would be prudent to make an early modest tightening to guard against the possibility of inflation picking up. And this is consistent with the forward-looking approach to monetary policy that the bank has been following for close to 20 years now, and which on balance has helped keep the economy on a sustainable path. So thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Rick, for that informative and interesting presentation. I'd like to now invite either questions or comments from the floor. Could I just ask you that you sort of just raise your hand just so we can get the microphone to you? And can I ask that you just state your name and where you're from prior to your comment or your questions? So who'd like to kick it off for us?
Hi, I don't know if this is working, but Rick, Peter Kerr from the Financial Review. You mentioned in your speech that banks had tightened lending standards to businesses, and that was having an impact on business borrowing, or at least lending to businesses. Is part of the story, though, that banks perhaps are lifting margins in excess of what they were perhaps pre-global financial crisis, and this is also having an impact on business borrowing?
Well, if you took a longer-term view, bank margins, which is the difference between the average interest rate they receive on their loans and the average interest rate they pay on all their sources of funds, really hasn't changed much in 5 or 6 years now. It's been basically fluctuating in a range of about 2.25% to 2.5%, and as I say, it's not really changing. So bank margins overall really haven't changed much over that 5 or 6 year period.
Hello, yep. Andrew Burrell from The Australian. There's been little improvement in employment in either Western Australia or Queensland just in recent months. Do you expect that the resources boom will have a transforming effect in these states in the next 12 to 18 months?
Well, I think our feeling is that there's two influences on both Queensland and Western Australia at the moment. One is the effect of the resource boom. The other is the consequence of the first phase of the resource boom through 2006, 2007 and into 2008. Because there's no doubt there was a lot of euphoria in both those states through that period. And, you had very large increases in household gearing, very large increases, extraordinary increases in house prices. And I think households are really now sort of struggling to cope with the after effects of that. But the truth is that, as the resource boom continues on, there's more and more income coming into the country, and eventually that will be the dominant force on these economies.
I might jump in there, Rick. In that, though, so a lot of commentators talk about a two-speed economy or going into a three-speed economy. How much of that comes into your thinking when you're looking at interest rates and the effects, either if you can compare it to the retail side of that industry, where it's at, and versus the resources area?
Mm. Well, there's no doubt that if you have an economy that's performing very differently across the various parts, it does complicate the setting of policy. But as we've said, there's only one interest rate for the country as a whole, and that interest rate has to be set for the good of the country as a whole. And that means that some parts of the economy will feel that the interest rate is too high. Other parts, that interest rate's probably too low. But overall, the differences between the states at the moment is not unusually wide.
Even New South Wales?
Even New South Wales. In fact, New South Wales is doing relatively well at the moment. So, we had a much more difficult period in New South Wales, again, following a period of very strong rises in house prices, which ended in New South Wales in 2003. So the worst time for New South Wales was 2004, 2005, going into 2006. But now the income growth that's occurred since then has allowed the economy to recover and overcome those high house prices.
Interesting. I found it very interesting. Sorry, Robin McClellan, CETA, I have to set a good example. thought it interesting what you said about a lot of the expansions in resources, particularly being financed through non-bank means and offshore. And so I hadn't thought about this before, but that must mean that the bank's efforts, if you will, to kind of address this two-speed economy through rate rises are really very hampered. There's a it's really in the international rate of lending that's going to affect it more so than Australia's. Could you comment on that?
Well, at the end of the day, though, monetary policy does have a very wide range in effect through the country, and while there will be pockets of the country that are accessing money in other currencies from offshore, that remains the minor part of the effect on the economy. We don't sense any loss of potency in monetary policy at all. I mean, I think monetary policy continues to be a very important influence on the economy.
Yes, Reg Appendard, UWA. Recently in the press there was an article indicating that the enormous developments on the northwest of the state, particularly the Pluto and the Gorgon, were going to generate a lot of income, and the Premier says this every time you speak with him. But there was also, this article was really expressing great concern that those resources are finite and they'll end in maybe a decade or so. Does the Reserve Bank take any interest in this kind of development? I mean, the states have a view, but does the Reserve Bank have a view that they can get involved in this kind of operation?
No, I think this is really a matter for governments rather than central banks. But one of the things that distinguishes Australia from some of the other resource countries around the world is that the supply of resources, while it's finite, is much longer lasting than, if you take another example of sort of Norway with its oil. You know, they've got a very short window there, and so they have to be very careful how they manage that. Here in Australia, there's just so many resources that it's a much longer running story. But specifically to answer your question, I think they're really issues that governments have to sort out.
Mincy Chung from ABC News. What is the bank's view on commercial banks raising their rates because of funding costs?
Well, as you know, there's been a lot of controversy over this over the last few weeks. I'm not going to comment on the decisions of individual banks. They're decisions they have taken, and it's up to them to explain those and justify those. But I think it probably is important to explain how all that fits together with monetary policy. Because I think at the crux of the debate, as far as I can tell, is that people feel there is or there should be a rule that says banks can't increase their lending rates more than the official interest rate set by the Reserve Bank, the cash rate. Well, that rule doesn't exist, it has never existed, and it would be quite risky for the stability of the financial system to have such a rule. The question is, why is that perception arisen? And when you look back, I think what's happened is that we went through a period from the second half of the 1990s and the first half of this decade where financial markets were very stable, so all interest rates were moving more or less in line. And so when banks were adjusting their interest rates to take account of their cost of funds, that in turn was lining up more or less with what the Reserve Bank was doing. So everything was moving in line with what the Reserve Bank was doing. But as you know, in the last 3 years, with the growth of the global financial crisis, that's no longer the case. We've seen very sharp increases in the cost of deposits, for example, much more than the increase in the cash rate. We've seen very big increases in the cost of long-term bonds. And unfortunately for the banks, regulators and the rating agencies are encouraging the banks to do more of their funding through these high-cost sources, through deposits and long-term bonds, because these are seen as being more stable. So this is all pushing up the cost of funds to the banks, more than the cash rate. And you look at any measure you like, basically most measures of the cost of funds have risen by at least 1% more than the cash rate in the last few years. And the banks obviously have to pass those costs on. As I said, on average, that's what they've done. The margin on banks' loans really hasn't changed over 5 or 6 years. They don't do that smoothly from month to month because the cost of funds is varying every month and it builds up, the cost builds up for a while, and then the banks eventually catch up and do an increase. And at that point, it looks like the margin's gone up, but eventually over the next few months, it erodes back down again. So basically, as I say, the margin's been fluctuating between 2.25% and 2.5%. Some people feel, well, what's that mean for monetary policy? Surely that means monetary policy is not as effective as it might have been. Well, the answer is no, because the Reserve Bank takes all that into account in setting the cash rate. So broadly speaking, the level of mortgage rates, for example, that exist at the moment is basically in line with what the Reserve Bank thinks it should be. And it's got there through a combination of rises in cash rates and rises in deposit rates and other funding costs. So, you know, the outcomes are basically okay, as far as we can tell.
I just might cut in there to add to that question. And those that have seen the stats, Australia is a net importer of capital, not only in the resources sector, but the country as a whole. And obviously, the instability through Europe, the issues in the US, we're paying for that because banks and mining companies and the like go and get that capital from overseas to fund themselves. How long when do you ever see it stabilising, or you know, will ever get back to the good old days where banks can get their funding at a reasonable cost over the cash rates?
Well, you know, the focus of the last few years, as you say, has been on the offshore funding. But the truth is, the biggest increase in the cost of funds the banks have experienced is on their domestic deposits. And there's just been tremendous competition for deposits because banks really value deposits at the moment. So you can get as much as 7% on a deposit at the moment. It's an extraordinarily high rate, given where the cash rate is. You get a much better rate on a household deposit for that than you do for some pension fund trying to place millions of dollars on deposit through the wholesale market. So this people are saying there's not as much competition in banking as there used to be. Well, I'm not sure that's correct. I think what's happened is the nature of the competition has changed. So if you go back through the period in the second half of the 90s and early this decade, when funds were plentiful, the banks were competing to lend the money, so people saw a lot of competition on the loan side. But now what's happened is because of the availability of funds to banks is actually quite tight, the competition is all on raising the money. And so it's the depositors that are getting extraordinary good deals, whereas if you go back 10 years ago, it was the borrowers who were getting the extraordinary good deals. But these things, as I say, the Reserve Bank, when it looks at it, takes all these issues into account in determining the overall level of interest rates and tries to calibrate all that out.
Andrew Pickford, independent consultant. Just when you talk about the repair of household balance sheets and at the state level and I guess at the household level, when you have the expected cost of electrical infrastructure flowing through largely through state government mechanisms, that's going to force a lot of bills accelerating at quite a high rate for a number of years. Can you, and this will be compounded by PV schemes and other apparently well-meaning things that simply load the cost up, and that will have to flow through in some way or shape. Can you just talk briefly in this repair phase of the household budgets, what those rather significant jumps will do, and especially as they're forecast or likely to continue for a number of years?
Well, as you note, the cost of a lot of utilities has risen a lot over the last little while, and it's continuing to do so. And you can say, well, that's really administrative matters by various governments, but the truth is it's really reflecting more than anything lack of capacity and the need to undertake new investments. So it really is a demand and supply story, and it is part of the overall inflationary situation in Australia, which the Reserve Bank has to take into account. And all these utility prices are factored into the inflation rate, and to the extent that they're growing above average, you know, if we have to maintain inflation, overall inflation at the target range, other prices have to grow more slowly, and that's really what's been happening. It's likely that the situation is going to have to continue. So the overall, you know, the overall cost to households is not only reflecting the very sharp rises in utility prices they're experiencing, but it's at the other extreme, they're having, you know, quite attractive prices for, say, the say electrical goods, which are, you know, fallen sharply in price. And the overall cost, well, in the last year or so, prices of goods in total are up, or the CPI in total is up 2.5%, which is what it should be.
Thank you very much for your talk. Paul Hardesty from Worley Parsons. In light of a recent UN sort of report that looked at valuing the externality damage associated with world GDP growth, what do you think the likelihood is, if any, that over the medium or even the longer term, that central banks might start to look at a genuine progress indicator type concept as a perhaps more complete measure of real success in our economy?
Well, that's a very big question, and it's not one that's going to be solved easily, and I think you'll find there's very mixed views on what to do about all that. I myself don't have anything substantial I can offer to that conversation, I'm afraid.